lovely to see you all and to see so many of you here this evening. I'm not going to take too much of your time, but for those of you that don't know us, well, I'm Evan Wilson and I'm one of the co-directors of this organisation here, the Culture Capital Exchange. Some of you know us well, and some of you, there are many, in fact, new faces tonight, but to just put a little bit of context perhaps into the proceedings this evening, Culture Capital Exchange is now about almost 11 years old. We were originally set up back in 2005 when we were known back then as LCACE, London Centre for Arts and Cultural Exchange, and some of you will remember that well. We are a network now of about 13 universities, higher education institutions of different scales and sizes here in London. And we also have a emerging network across the UK as well, in different parts of the country, and very much throughout and over the years, a lot of our work really has focused on bringing together the research world with the arts, with the cultural, and with the creative sectors. And as some of you will know, we do that in a whole host of different ways throughout the typical year. And one of our strands of work is what, in a sort of a shorthand parlance, we might refer to as public engagement, I suppose, or work in which we produce work that takes place typically in public settings and that very often also involves some degree of project working and interaction between the research communities and our creative and cultural communities. And often those are bound together in all sorts of very interesting ways as well. And the notion really for our salon series isn't entirely new. We've been running salons now over the last 2 or 3 years in different areas such as design and also in philosophy. And in particular, the philosophy salons and kind of why we are here in the pokey little sort of anteroom tonight is that our philosophy salons are very much kind of developed with and in connectivity with the philosophy department at King's College London. And so we've worked over the years. And I'm really delighted that Sasha Golub, who is a philosopher in the department, was very, very keen to expand the salons that we developed and to encourage a dialogue and a discussion, really, between the department and with artists and in and around the topic of visual arts in particular, which was music to my ears when you approached us wishing to do this. And even more so, I was so delighted when Jane Wildgoose, who I'm sure many of you know here tonight, agreed to be with us here this evening. You know, Jane is a really extraordinary artist. I'm not going to say a lot more to spoil the presentation here tonight, but thank you so much. I'm really, really pleased that you could join us. And without further ado, Sasha, I'll hand to you. Thank you.
Fantastic. So thank you for coming, ladies and gentlemen. Let me say that first. But before we begin, Evelyn's very kindly given permission for me to make a small announcement that I think might be of interest to some of you. So I'm delighted to say that King's College London will shortly be launching the Centre for Philosophy and the Visual Arts, which I will be the inaugural director. And our aim is to bring together artists, curators, art theorists, art critics, and philosophers to think about contemporary artistic practice and to think about individual works. So if you're working in those areas as a curator, as a practitioner, as an art theorist, and you might be interested in collaborating with us in some way, please have a word with me at the end or send me an email and I would be delighted to talk to you. That's exactly the kind of thing our centre seeks to support. So now to the main event. I'm absolutely delighted to have Jane Wildgoose here. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on introductions because I want to leave the time for the talk, but I think, as you'll see, Jane's practice is fascinating and diverse. James can speak for about 20 minutes or so, taking you through some of the themes of her work. Then I might pose a few questions of my own, but we'll gradually open it up to a broader Q&A, and I hope you'll all be able to contribute to that. So, Jane.
Thank you.
And
I would like to say too, it's wonderful to see so many of you here. Thank you for coming to join us. Can you all hear me at the back? Okay. Just wave your hands if I fade a bit. Well, as you all now know, we're here for a philosophy and the arts salon. And it occurred to me that since our agenda is memory, narrative, and imagination, maybe I'd start by telling you a story. And take us 4.5 years ago, I was in the School of Art and Design History at Kingston University in an interview. I was presenting my proposal for my doctoral research, which was to be practice-based. And the head of the school, not unreasonably, said, "Why does it have to be practice-based?" And I look back on this has resonated my answer so many times over the years. It came straight from my heart and my gut. I was shocked by how quickly I responded and didn't let it go through my head. I said, because as an artist, I believe that I need to put myself in the picture. And what I meant by that, I see heads nodding, hooray. I probably don't really need to explain it. But what I meant was, I am prepared to engage with my emotions, with the subjective, but also I hope to be rigorous with them. So putting myself in the picture, memory, narrative, and imagination. And some of you I know, it's lovely to see you, know my work. A lot of you probably don't. So I thought you really needed some context, and I would start by giving you a brief overview of some of the work I've been doing with collections over the last 15 years, and then lead you on to the work that I've been doing with human remains, possession and display. They're not entirely unconnected. I am keeper of the Wild Goose Memorial Library. That's a self-appointed role. I've learned to say that it's a performative role, but I prefer self-appointed. The Wild Goose Memorial Library is a collection, it's my collection, and it is made up of found and made objects, documents, books, photographs. I call it a library and not a museum because I am really interested in the way that we form associations with objects and with the material world. And it started, although it began to have a formal life with me calling myself the keeper in 2003 when I was making a radio programme for BBC Radio 4, it started much, much earlier in my career in a very informal and intuitive way when I was a costume designer. And I became extremely interested in the social and costume history of mourning, particularly in the West, but not exclusively so. And I started collecting and reading books about the subject. I started collecting ephemera and objects, hair jewellery, mourning stationery, prints, things like the Day of the Dead. And I developed a really strong interest in the role of the artist and the role of the craftsman working with death and working with mourning. So I also became very interested in artists working with anatomy. And as we'll see as I go on, these subjects have reiterated and grown throughout my career, even though I was a costume designer when I started out. And I think that's also very important to my understanding of my perception of the material world. My collection lives in my home, in the room that I principally use as a studio. And as I have come to reflect more and more, particularly over the last 4.5 years, about what it is that I'm doing with my collection, which started off as a research resource, is sometimes the subject of my work, and is constantly a touchstone. And I realised that really my response to the material world is a very Proustian one. Proust, as we know, or you will all know, as he dipped the Madeleine cake into the cup of lime tea, he was flooded with bodily sensations which triggered his childhood memories. And reflecting on that experience, he says, the past is hidden outside the realm of intellect, in the sensation that material objects will give us. And while I use my intellect a lot with historical research, I constantly want to explore and examine my emotions as well. And I began to be able to test this in relation to other collections with established collections in 2000, thanks to the Arts Council, who awarded a series of small grants across the country for artists. And I was particularly lucky because two artists independently came to me and said, would you like to work with me? One with a costume museum down in Mexhill-on-Sea, a tiny museum, and the other here in London, Sally Hampson, collecting mudlarking on the banks of the River Thames. I just bought the big cabinet. I was really starting to formalise my collection. And she wanted to look at the way in which people collect detritus, what appears in the mud on the shore as the tide goes out. Some people very conscientiously, some of us more casually, but to think about how, as we pick up detritus, and my collection felt like detritus at that time, they were objects that very often I felt kind of washed up and were not particularly loved or wanted. We were looking at the way in which displaying those bits of dreck actually gives them narrative potential and associations in the minds of the people who collect. And I was obviously doing something right, because working with collections by the end of that decade, I was in America working with the collections at Yale University. The Natural History Collection, the University Art Gallery, the Decorative Arts, and with the Rare Books Department at the Centre for British Art. I had been commissioned to devise and design, they built it for me, a cabinet in celebration of two 18th century women. And they were Margaret, Duchess of Portland at the top there, and Mary Delaney. Margaret, Duchess of Portland, was one of the greatest collectors of natural history and artifacts in the 18th century. Her collection was sold when she died at her instruction. It took almost 40 days to sell over 4,000 compound lots of shells, predominantly corals, but all kinds of natural history and decorative arts. And in fact, the Portland Vase is named after her family. She bought it when it came to this country, when William Hamilton brought it. Her great friend was Mary Delaney, and she was a draftswoman, a botanist, horticulturalist. She wrote a novel, she was an embroiderist, and she also, encouraged by the Duchess of Portland, at the end of her life, when she was in her 70s, began making these incredibly beautiful and accurate, botanically accurate, illustrations of flowers. She made, between the age of 72 and 80, almost 1,000 of them. They're in the British Museum. You can see one or two of them in the Enlightenment Gallery. And I was obviously drawing, I was drawing on Delaney's correspondence, I was drawing on the Duchess of Portland's catalogue of the sale of her collection in order to think about how to represent their friendship. But I was also drawing on secondary sources, and particularly I was very inspired by Joe Dahn's writing on Mary Delaney collecting ceramics, which were all given by friends, had associations with the friends that gave them, and appeared in her home, as did the Duchess's collection, with the natural history. And Jo Dahn says, like many women of their time, Mary Delaney constructed a decorative objectscape within which to situate herself almost like a self-portrait. And so through material culture, I was aiming to make a portrait of their friendship. And I had a really extraordinary opportunity, which was, while that work was on show in America, I also had the opportunity to show some of my ideas in a site-specific form here in London, in what must be one of my favourite collections, the Soane Museum, which has been a great inspiration to me all the time I've been in London. And again, one of the things which I love about that collection, there are many things, but what Nicholas Savage has observed about Soane's collecting, which is that for him what mattered a great deal was the idea behind an object, the story that it told, the connections and associations. So for instance, in his library, he had several copies of the same books because he cared about who the book had originally belonged to, as well as its contents and its binding. And I'm just going to bring us up to date. My most recent installation working with the collection was last year at Waddesdon Manor, this extraordinary kind of French chateau in the Buckingham countryside, built by Ferdinand de Rothschild at the end of the 19th century. It is full of the most exquisite 18th century decorative arts. I'm sure some of you know it. Rather perversely, I decided to focus not on the rather luxurious 18th century art, but actually to focus on two very, very humble objects. I'd actually asked the curator that I was working with if they had anything with hair in it, because I was interested in hair jewellery. And she said, yes, in the archives, we have this tiny photograph and a lock of hair. They belonged to the wife of Ferdinand, who built Waddesdon. He built it in the decade after her death. They were cousins, they married. She died 18 months after they married, in childbirth with their stillborn son. And he too has written. Despite the disparity in our collections, he is the virtuosic mind, the kind of mudlarker's dream. He too wrote about the way in which works of art are desirable not only for their rarity or beauty, but for their associations, the memories they evoke. You see a theme emerging. So whether I'm working at home with my own collection, whether I'm working outside with established collections, or whether I'm taking that collection at home in my heart with me outside, I am always concerned with the way in which I respond to material culture through my body and the way that other people do as well. Which gets us onto the human remains. Wheeling back to the late 1990s, at the time when I was transitioning between being a costume designer and the keeper of the Wild Goose Memorial Library, I got very interested in the case of a sculptor, Anthony Noel Kelly, who got into a lot of trouble for taking anatomical specimens from the Royal College of Surgeons, which he cast in plaster and gilded as his artworks. I did not condone the theft, but I did think that he was having a very rough time in the press as an artist who dared to work with death. And it was not long after the Sensation exhibition at the Royal Academy, and I think there was a bit of tidal wave from that going on. Anyway, I got so upset about the way that he was being treated in the press that I wrote a letter to the Evening Standard, but it got to 2,000 words. And I realised it wasn't a letter, and ultimately it was published in the New Statesman. And I found myself in a public debate about possession and display of human remains, which of course came out of all my collecting and research, which I had been doing for many years. And I went to his trial, I listened to all the testimonies, and particularly his. And to coincide with his appeal, I published another article in which I compared the language that he used about the grave robbing that he'd done with the language of historical anatomists going back to Vesalius and through to the 18th century. And what struck me was the language they used was unbelievably similar. Of course, human remains, their possession and display were a very big story at the end of the 20th century. And the year after Tony Kelly went to prison for his theft, the Alder Hague scandal hit the newspapers. The story about children's organs being retained without parental consent after children had died in hospitals in Liverpool, Bristol and elsewhere in the country. And the year after that, in 2000, Tony Blair and the then Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard, issued a joint statement in response to lobbying from Indigenous peoples about human remains, ancestral remains collected under colonial rule, which are in our museums. The Human Tissue Act was introduced in response to the Alder Hay scandal, and a small section in it dealt with the issue of the National Museums and claims from Indigenous peoples for ancestral remains and their return. And at that time, the Department of Culture, Media and Sport also published a guidance for museums on the subject. The following year, I found myself commissioned by the Natural History Museum to write a report on their human remains collection in the light of the new legislation. And at a time when they, under the new legislation, were considering their first repatriation of 17 Tasmanian individuals' bones. I had to do quite a lot of historical research into the history of possession and display of human remains at the museum. I also interviewed curators and people who worked at the museum now, and I presented my report from the point of view, I don't know whether you can see, printed by the Wild Goose Memorial Library, and looking at this historical and contemporary evidence, the scientific point of view, through the lens of my Proustian approach to the material world. While I was doing my research, I spent an afternoon in the archives where I came across a pile of letters which revealed that there had been a very active program of human skull collecting in the colonies from the Natural History Museum during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. This was part of what Stephen Jay Gould has referred to as the heyday of craniology, the measuring of heads and brain capacity in order to come up with hierarchically racially differentiating theories of the so-called races of mankind. Thank goodness, long since discredited. However, I discovered that through looking at the gallery guides, that human skulls were displayed in the public galleries at the Natural History Museum, still part of the British Museum, as late as 1931, displayed explicitly in that way. And as you can imagine, that had quite an impact on me. In fact, I really wanted to do something about it. I had the opportunity to make a radio program, and I decided to turn the questions that were being asked of museums on myself and on two human skulls that were donated to the library. And you can ask me about how they got there later if you're concerned about the ethics of that. I consulted with a series of experts, asking them, trying to find out as much as I could about what the provenance was of these skulls, who they were, where they'd come from, why they were in this country. And I also, at the end of each interview, asked each of the experts, what should I do with the skulls? One of those experts was Phil Gordon, the head of Aboriginal collections at the Australian Museum in Sydney. He is an Aboriginal man himself, and he has been working with repatriation for over 25 years. He said there was a huge trade in human remains for museums under colonial rule, and he felt that it is a fundamental human right that people should do what they think is right with their ancestral remains. And he also said quite unequivocally, we want our ancestors back. That's how I ended up in the School of Art and Design History at Kingston University at that interview. I decided to do a PhD in which I would consider a comparative study of the collection and interpretation of human skulls for scientific purposes and human hair for commemorative purposes in the late 19th century in London. I would present my findings as an archive of my library, and it would be an artist's response to the DCMS guidance for the care of human remains in museums. And I'm winding up now, I'm almost there. I wanted to ask how an artist's comparative study of human skulls and hair, I was looking at a vast collection of human skulls that was amassed at the Royal College of Surgeons, which went during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that went to the Natural History Museum after the Second World War. And I wanted to consider how my artist's response might contribute to our understanding of this legacy. One of the things that I did as a practitioner, working with my research into commemorative tributes made out of hair, was to make, and it's an ongoing work in progress, was to make a wreath out of human hair, donated hair, and every flower that I make commemorates the skull of somebody that I know is documented in the Royal College of Surgeons catalogues, explicitly saying that they were grave robbed from a recent or ancient grave, taken from the recently dead in hospital, or from an execution ground or a battleground. I presented my work at the Crypt Gallery St Pancras as an archive of my library. And I chose the Crypt Gallery St Pancras for that Proustian reason. I wanted my visitors to think subjectively about the dead and how they are kept and how they are memorialised. I wanted them to come out of the sunny world of sound bites and social media and down into the labyrinth, into the damp and the dark. I wanted them to know that there were 557 people buried between 1822 and 1854 behind the walls of the gallery, and that they were memorialised there. And I presented, I made a big reading room with all my historical comparative research. And in the centre of the crypt, I presented my commemorative wreath in this amazing kind of passageway, which is full of gravestones, a kind of archive of the dead. As I said, every hair flower commemorated an individual in the catalogues from the Royal College of Surgeons. Every individual is numbered, and the circumstances where known of their collection is detailed. And so each hair flower has the name of the person who gave the hair, who donated the hair, signed on a mourning card, and a larger one umbilically joined to it with a little black ribbon has the number of the skull which it commemorates. A pair of ledgers also have this documentation that are presented with the wreath. And finally, I asked a leading question of all my visitors, very explicitly. I asked them, should I continue this work as an artist, or should I shelve it as an academic thesis? I'm pleased to say that I received an overwhelmingly emphatic response that I should continue as an artist. And I think Kay Syrad, the poet, who sent me a 4-page handwritten letter after the exhibition, sums it up most eloquently when she said, overall, the exhibition is the aesthetic, physical expression of values, of ethics. And if it is possible to experience this rather than read it alone, the ideas and knowledge will extend, affect, and bring change. Over to you, Sasha.
So, first off, ladies and gentlemen, just let me apologise for the cramped conditions here. The first lecture I ever gave, the first talk I ever gave when I was a graduate student, there were two people there, and one had come in to keep warm. So, I'm always quite happy to see lots of people. What I'm going to do is just talk very, very briefly, just pick out a couple of themes that struck me and what Jane said, and then we'll open it up either to her response or to a Q&A. So, the first thing is I think the 20th century is often characterized in terms of this very invidious opposition between the rational and the irrational. You're either rational or you're irrational. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about Jane's work is this idea that one can bring in an emotional perspective, particularly a systemic emotional perspective, through the role of the artist that is nevertheless deeply, deeply rigorous. And it seems that supporting this is this Proustian idea of what you might call a somatic memory, okay? It's when you touch the objects, when you walk into the crypt, you feel the temperature going down, that's the point at which memory in some sense takes hold, and that's how we should think about it. And of course, what's particularly interesting in Jane's work is that she combines that kind of project with, in some sense, traditional ways, more academic ways of thinking about the past, more academic ways of thinking about where we've come from. So, from the scientific collections to the catalogues of who was buried, where and when. So you have these different notions of memory, different ways of thinking about the past. And that seems extraordinarily interesting because it seems one of the issues on which our society is changing very rapidly. So many of us now are self-writing every day. We're posting pictures of what we do every day. We're tweeting comments about what we do every day. In some sense, narrativizing our lives in a sort of encyclopedic fashion. And what you see in Jane's work is this combination of, I think, the academic research with, as I say, this sort of somatic memory, the memory that rushes through you as you touch the object. That seems to be extraordinarily interesting. The second thing that struck me in what she was saying is this idea of taxonomy and the artist as collector. So there's a remark that I'm sure many of you know, Foucault quoting Bourdieu's at the start of The Order of Things, where he's talking about this extraordinary idea of a radically different taxonomy, that animals might be divided up not as mammals and fish and so forth, but rather as things that belong to the emperor, or things that look like fleas from a distance, or things that have knocked over water pitchers. They do radically distinct taxonomies. It seems to be one of the big philosophical questions of this century and the last, how we think about a radically distinct way of carving up the world. And what struck me in Jane's work is this idea of the artist as in some sense collector or taxonomizer. So what's happening, it seems to me, or part of what's happening, these very rich works such as the Memorial Library, is a bringing together of objects, these somatic objects I talked about before, to create a certain kind of synthesis in which we see ourselves and in which we also go beyond ourselves. So I think this very interesting quote, when she's talking about the Duchess of Portland case, that was a situation where those women, in some sense, created themselves. We'll get there. Those women, in some sense, created themselves through creating this collection. Yeah. So the subject there is emerging out of the act of taxonomizing, the act of bringing together and making relations. And the artist is intervening in that by setting up new taxonomies or raising new taxonomies. So that seems an extraordinarily interesting
conception
of the artist's role. Do you want to give me one second?
Okay.
I'll hand over. The last thing I wanted to point out was mortality. Okay. So it seems to me that one of the issues philosophically in the last century is that there are two ways of thinking about death. Okay. So one, it's a deeply private experience. Okay. This is the kind of thing you see in people like Heidegger and Sartre. No one else knows what it's like for me to die. No one else can die for me. It's this unique relationship that only I have, that's shut off from all my loved ones, that's completely ingraspable to others. So that's one way. Another way you often see is a completely objectified notion of death. Okay? We measure the skulls in the anatomy collection like we could measure a sack of potatoes or measure a set of floorboards, and then we use them to construct a certain view of the world. So it seems to me the last century is dominated by these two options on death. Either deeply private, deeply, and of course there are religious links here, almost confessional aloneness with it, or mathematical, quantitative, in the service of certain scientific projects. I think what's so interesting about some of the works we've seen here is that there's a notion of death that simultaneously transcends lots of those issues. It's both deeply personal, okay? So one, the people choose to be involved in the work, and it helps us think through what the personal phenomenology of, say, mourning is. Okay, you keep the hair locket, okay? And that's the basis through which you think about death, through you think about your relation to the departed. That's your personal experience of the missing husband or brother or father or son or mother or wife. So this personal aspect, but on the other hand, what's interesting is it doesn't occlude in her work the public aspect, that of course these practices of thinking about death were subject to very specific public and social controls, often embedded in larger and very interesting public and social projects. So for example, the anthropological work is a particular view of death in the period, in the service of a particular agenda with all the economic and militaristic consequences that went with that. So those, I've only touched on a few of them here, and I'm sure Jane will want to come back to them and have fascinating things to say about them, but those, just off the top of my head, struck me as three things worth highlighting. This idea of moving beyond a rational, irrational boundary, okay, both at the level of the somatic object and at the level of an artist who is also an academic in some sense. Then this idea of the taxonomizer or the collector. And finally, the question of how we should see death in the modern period. You know, particularly given that many of us are going to experience a long old age, how should we think about death in this modern period? And how can we combine the public and private aspects of it? Jane, I don't know if you want to say anything in response to that.
There was certainly something that I wanted to say about this, actually, and what you were saying about taxonomy. One of the things that was fascinating for me about this project was that both the Duchess of Portland and Mary Delaney, a very, very upright woman, Mary Delaney, were on the cutting edge of science. They both understood and knew about and employed Linnaean taxonomy, which was quite shocking at the time because Linnaeus was using sexual analogies about botany. And I think it's quite extraordinary, actually. When I first found out about the Duchess of Portland, it was with a reference to the frontispiece to the catalogue of the sale of her collection. And all that was said about it was that she had the money and she could collect, and that's about as far as it went scientifically. Didn't take a great deal more research to discover that actually she was very well respected as a scientist in her lifetime, though she was very good at diplomatically navigating the social world as an aristocratic woman who used science. And one of the things that I found so fascinating about the two of them was, and what I was going to say was, sorry, I lost my thread there, she hired Linnaeus's favourite pupil, Daniel Solander, who of course was very busy here with the British Museum, to catalogue her shell collection. It was so enormous, and he died so young, that he hardly got started on it, but it was said to be four times the size of Linnaeus's own shell collection. So she knew what she was doing. And when Mary Delaney published her botanical illustrations, she had, the front page says that she has ordered them in the Linnaean system. So these two women were right at the forefront of taxonomy. However, they also lived with it in their homes. And there are descriptions of George III coming to visit at Bulstrode, the country house of Margaret, Duchess of Portland, and they were wandering through her china closet, which was full of her curiosities, whatever that may mean. A room that where china and scientific study were occupied. And Mary Delaney, in her letters as well, talks about how they're going out and collecting mushrooms, they're looking at books, they're trying to name them. They were serious scientists, as well as making decorative arts. So that, and one of the things, I won't stop, one of the things that I really loved was that they could embrace both the decorative and the scientific, and they were on that cusp before they got split apart.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's seems to be one of the really significant developments in the last century of artistic practice, is the idea that relations really matter. You know, so I've got an ordinary Brillo box and I put it in a certain space and suddenly it's transformed in various ways. And obviously what's happening here is you've got a set of shells, but you put them next to each other in a certain order and you have something that's simultaneously a groundbreaking scientific theory, simultaneously a way of constructing an identity for yourself within a very rigid society, simultaneously a piece of decorative work within your home, simultaneously a story of your life, and simultaneously a great piece of science. And that seems extraordinarily interesting, that just bringing these things together, one's able to do all those things. So, unless there's anything else you want to say, I suppose we just throw it open. So who would like to comment or questions? Yes, please.
I was really struck when you said about the sensation of the object, because I think that is something the arts brings in relation to the true senses of the object. But I was thinking about in terms of your work, where you're talking about the hair and the stones, the bits of the body and right that they are beyond there, but they are devoid of sensation. They're ultimately without sensation. But we as living beings touch them with sensation. Is there something that we want that contact?
My kind of central theme that ran through my comparative study of the objectification of skulls for scientific purposes in the 19th century and the use of hair as a commemorative subject was actually the work of Lewis Hyde and his work on gift exchange. And I was particularly struck that he talks about the way that gifts circulate in a market economy without any emotional attachment. But he compares that with the gift economy and talks about what he calls it. He calls the commercial market being driven by logos, logic and reason, and interestingly differentiation. And he talks about the gift economy being driven by an erotic force, that uses the word eros, but one that binds people together, that is associative. And so I used that as my model through my comparative study. Of course, what was interesting was that while it was a very helpful thing for me to be able to think about the objectification of the skulls in scientific terms, I also realized that there was a gift economy going on, because those men out in the colonies, medical men often, or colonial officers, who felt very far from the metropolis and a sense of being outcasts to some extent, certainly had one supplier who was a surgeon who felt that way, by sending skulls back for the cause of science, it was a kind of erotic exchange in Lewis Hyde's terms, in that they bound one another together and they also endorsed their principles, which was to turn a deaf ear to the material that might otherwise speak to them in the way that people who wore hair jewelry, I usually wear some, understood. I'm not sure that entirely answers your question in terms of the idea of being animate or inanimate, but this is, I think, where the imagination comes in, and the will to pick up on or to imagine the animation of the material world.
And it's extraordinarily interesting, just one of the many things there is this. The fact that these people who were sending back the skulls were also, through seeing the objects in that way, constructing their own particular self-identity. You know, they got
Absolutely.
To be rational men of science, presumably, through this act.
Yeah.
Okay, so just as, again, we have this kind of subject-object interconstruction. Who else would like to?
Sorry, this is for Jane. When you were discussing the extract from Proust, it really reminded me of this theologian, Lorensky, who he writes about the importance of sensation. And he was a priest and a theologian, and he felt that the sensation that we get from art, and particularly nature, could often lead to sort of feelings of the divine. And I was wondering, sort of, to what extent do you agree with that?
There's a bit of a pagan in me, is all I would say on that. My daughter used to say that to me. She'd say, "Mom, you're just a complete pagan." It just comes naturally. I totally agree with that idea, particularly about nature. And yes, and I think that is something else in modern life, our connection with nature, our ability to let it inspire our imaginations and our sense of our wider self. Is something, and certainly something Mary Delaney understood, a rapturous writing about nature in her correspondence. I think there was a point.
Yes, there's one, yes, please.
I was interested in what you said at the beginning about the fact you called it a library rather than a museum, because it seems to me that one of the really important sensations about an object is touch and the tactility in holding something. And I wondered, therefore, whether actually you called it a library rather than a museum, because a museum is about look but don't touch, but a library is about take and hold and explore.
Well, that's wonderful, and I should have brought a copy of it with me. I actually wrote an essay about this that was published with the photographer Rudolf Backer's photographs of an old paper-based archive in Horsley Town Hall, and he asked me to write something to accompany it. And it was when I was researching in the archives at the Royal College of Surgeons and reading hundreds of letters in a big, big bound books. And the smell of the book reminded me, it was a totally Proustian moment, reminded me of going to my father's house, which had been emptied after he died, to pick up his music books. And the only thing that was left there, apart from the music books, a church organ and a grand piano, was his bed. And when I pulled back the cover on the bed, his clothes had been laid out. And it was like finding his body. And so the smell of the book reminded me, absolutely Proustian, reminded me about, and I used it as a vehicle to write about this idea about the subjectivity when contemplating the body. So yes, I do agree with you, and it is a very important part of what I do, that people can handle objects. And the first, I showed a picture briefly of the first project that I did in a costume museum. And what was wonderful about it was a local museum, it was run by local people, it was volunteers. It's now part of an accredited museum. But the freedom where I said, well, I'm looking for Miss Havisham in amongst the wedding dresses, and they would say, get that box down, you'll be interested in that. And to open a box, and it still smelled of sweat. There were grass stains on the dresses, and I could take them out and draw them. And I realised then that I'd been drawing costume in museums with glass in front, and exactly that difference, even actually if you're not touching the material, that we don't just see with our eyes, you all know, it's with our bodies, and the closer the contact, even if we're not touching with the object, the more we register, the more we understand about that object, and perhaps about ourselves.
I'm curious, because it's not really been touched upon, and maybe it isn't something you're concerned about, but the idea of especially big institutions owning these collections and thereby also owning part of that knowledge seems incredibly powerful. And you coming into those collections must be an odd imbalance, perhaps.
Not always comfortable.
So how do you feel about that, and then how do you feel about that in terms of your own collection becoming now part of the establishment?
My collection, I hope, will never become part of the establishment, and I feel that whatever happens to it after I'm gone, it's really important that it doesn't, that it keeps the kind of life that you're really alluding to. Certainly, yes, questions of power, massive, and massive around human remains, but any kind of object. And exactly that, I'm sure you all know, because it's been getting some radio time, Tiffany Jenkins has just brought out a new book. She was writing about contested human remains in museums, and she has just brought out a book called Keeping Their Marbles, which I have to admit, I haven't had a chance to read yet, but I know what her thesis is because I've heard her talking about it, and it's the same one about human remains, which is that somehow there was a golden moment in the history of museums, that the British Museum is a great holder of world culture. Everyone can come here and see world culture here, and she, I know that her argument is in the title, that despite the fact that many objects in our established museums were plundered, that we should hold on to them. I don't share her opinion. I do think that these objects are absolutely redolent with power, depending on their histories. Obviously not everything in museums is by any means, thank goodness, but those that have been plundered. I actually called my report at the Natural History Museum, which wasn't entirely popular, Possession 9/10 of the Law? And I found a wonderful quote on an online legal dictionary which said that that statement is not a rule of law, it's a rule of force. And that was my starting point.
Yes.
One of your themes is memory. I was just wondering if you had any tangible experience during your life with regards to death, but not like one of your close members of family, or maybe anything that struck you. Why do you choose death instead of other material experiences like landscapes or something?
Yeah, very good question. I grew up.
Could you repeat the question?
Okay. What, why death?
So the question was, why did she particularly choose death as opposed to other material experiences? And was there some particular instance in her life that led to this?
Yeah. Okay, like everything, it's not a straightforward one example. It's kind of an accretion, as my work tends to be accretions. I grew up on the South Coast, right by the sea. I was a beachcomber from a very early age. It took me until I was an adult to realise that all the things I thought were beautiful and collected on the beach were dead. It was a big graveyard. I was surrounded, I lived in a modernist bungalow, surrounded by very, very elderly people who were my friends when I was a small child, who lived in these little modernist bungalows with crinkled windows full of sunshine and Edwardian and Victorian collections. And these were people who had lived through two world wars. And again, I was not conscious, but it got absolutely kind of imbued in me. My dad was a really, really enthusiastic church organist, and I spent a lot of time in old churches and graveyards. And then at the age of 17, which is far more serious, I was living with my mother and my grandfather, my dearly beloved members of my family. And my grandfather was in his 80s and completely blind. And my mother very rapidly suffered a very severe disablement, and I became their carer. And so my understanding of life and death, and they really in many ways, towards the end of their lives, they lived quite a lingering kind of twilight, life and death. And that really had, so all of those things together, I would say, are the formative experiences. That have made me the person and the artist that I am.
You still attribute some positive connotation to that, though, don't you?
Well, there's a wonderful book by Aldous Huxley. I'm trying to remember the title of it. It's not well known, but it is exactly about this. So it's set in on the west coast of America with a very, very wealthy man trying to get the power of eternal life. And of course, that would be pretty horrible. Life, there is no life without death. Decay is very lively. There's the wonderful Darwin's grandfather wrote the most wonderful, huge poems, in one of which he says, when a monarch or a mushroom dies, basically he says, death is just a change of forms. The same thing happens. Suddenly, all of this life springs out of death. And that is how the cycle happens. And that's the pagan in me speaking.
Fantastic, yes, in the back, please.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
This question about museums and access. I've been doing some work up in Lancashire recently with the
Museum
and the Rachel Pace Shuttleworth textile collection. And that struck a chord with me because when Rachel Shuttleworth was putting together her collection, which is mostly dresses and lace, etc., she would wear it. and she would walk down the dining table wearing it. And so one of the things they're looking at the moment is how do you reinvigorate this sense of accessibility and make it less precious, because you know, part of what they're saying is, we've got the best collection in the world, it's not even necessarily that special, and we've got duplicates. So maybe there are things that we can do that would deaccession bits of it, bars of things, etc. And there was a little shrunk in the
head. Okay.
So I think that, so the other reason I think this is relevant is that in this period of time where museums are being handed over to communities, because the local authorities can no longer afford to run them, I wonder to what extent this is going to change this idea about the precious and the fixed. I think we may use it.
Absolutely, and one of the things I would really love to have talked about this evening, but I really was trying to keep it as short as possible, was the research that I did into making the hair wreath. And I went to the what bills itself as the only collection of hair work in the world, and I strongly recommend that you all look it up. It's called Leila's Hair Museum. It's got a fabulous website. And this collection was started in 1956 by a hairdresser, Leila Cahoon, and she's been collecting hair wreaths as well as hair jewellery for all of those years. And of course she's not a museum professional, she is a practitioner, and she's been buying them in flea markets and antique stores, and often they're broken. And so she does, and one of the things that was really struck, I went out there and worked with her, she taught me. It's in Independence, Missouri, on the far rural outskirts of Kansas City. And one of the things that really struck me, and I do have very good friends who are conservators, but how much they would be horrified by what she does. But on the other hand, what she has done through buying things that are broken, taking them apart, putting them back together again, she's reverse engineered the processes, and I spent 3 days sitting across the table with her, from her in her museum, learning from her how to make this fairly lost craft. And you know, that's not going to happen in the conservative world. I think we need both,
yeah,
actually, and I think there's room for both, and it's very easy to be polarised about it.
Yeah, I know that seems to fit where some things came up earlier. You know, the question about the library and the museum, what's the museum doing, what's the function of collecting these things and bringing them together, what different kind of dynamics and trajectories might there be along which one might do that. Who else? Yes?
You talk about not wanting your collection preserved.
Not preserved. Not made establishment.
Okay.
And I see a
so
distinction.
What do you see happening to
them? Oh, that's such a good question.
And then, so the further question is, you talk about your daughter, what do you see happening to you when you die? Are you going to make it?
My daughter hasn't asked me. And I did say, should there be funds? And I know there won't be. I quite like to be like one of those martyred saints in the 17th century that were bejeweled and stuck in a glass case. But failing that, I have also talked very seriously about my daughter to my daughter about the fact that really this is for the people who come afterwards. I don't mind too much, although I care very much about Aboriginal peoples and the power dynamic with us having stolen historically their bodies, their ancestors' bodies, and holding on to them. I personally don't mind too much, but I know my daughter will.
But it would be great fun to leave the instructions.
And it's interesting you saying that, because that was how I discussed it. When she was about 15 when she started talking to me about this. She also talked about what should happen to the cabinet, which was another story. And I did think afterwards that perhaps it is easier when people leave very clear instructions and say, this is what I want, and then everyone feel good that that is what that person wanted. So that's something I'm thinking about at the moment.
And then this blacklist of people who are not allowed.
We can have a whip round for the bejeweled case.
But also you were asking what I would like to happen to the collection. I mean, in my pipe dreams, I would love to be able to build somewhere out of recycled wood and cabinets, preferably overlooking water, where I could make it more publicly accessible.
But then will it stop when I die?
Well, if in an ideal world,
well,
if that happened, of course I'm going to die. later rather than sooner, we hope. I would like to think that actually it could be established as an idea, as which it is, as much as objects, and that it can continue growing on a set of principles which respect these ideas about the dynamics of collections, about the dangers of power, and the accessibility, and also the stimulus to the imagination.
What's the problem? If you see that the perception creates a sense of power,
it depends
you don't want to have that sense of power. Would you accept something coming and taking something away, or having something is?
One of the things, when I wasn't able to talk about how the library came about as a sort of formal thing with me as its keeper, and that was through making a radio programme where a wonderful radio producer and playwright called Gregory Whitehead had bought one of Nelson's hares on eBay for $52.50, and he was making a radio programme and we were emailing about how to go about doing this, and at some point he said, how shall I bring you into the narrative? And I said, oh, you're going to have an appointment at the Wildcats Memorial Library. He leapt at the idea and I went, oops, I better make that happen. So then when he was terribly impressed with it, I was very nervous he wouldn't be, and so was his colleague from the BBC. And I kind of felt I was onto something, and so I thought, okay, I'd set up a whole legend about when it was open and what the collections were when he came, and I printed out this information. And I thought, well, maybe I could have an annual opening. So I threw an opening and I invited people to come in the morning, and people started saying to me, I think Debbie was there, possibly Graham as well. People started saying, is it your birthday? And I said, no. But people have brought me objects for the collection. And from that day, and I never, ever, ever ask for things, people do from time to time give me objects for the collection. Of course I do. Yes.
Can you display them?
Whenever I can. At one time, I thought that my mission would be always to have everything on display. Because people gave me things, that became impossible. And also because I used the cabinet as a kind of three-dimensional sketchbook. So, for instance, when I was doing the Yale project, I actually emptied it out, and I was using it as a means of working out how the part of the things I was making were going to be set on the shelves. And the design of the cabinet that they built for me, I was referring all the time to that and another cabinet I have to be sure that it works in the human kind of register.
So if you'll forgive me for jumping at that.
Not very often.
So we have time for one more. Does anyone like a final word? So I might ask you one question if you don't mind. As you know, when we talked about this, I said that this is part of a series, so we've done lots of sounds with visual artists, asking about their work, and there are various questions that we like to ask each practitioner. One of the reasons we do this is because they produce radically different answers for each practitioner. And in particular, there's some questions that some artists regard as obvious or obviously important, and other artists regard the same question as deeply ill-formed or deeply problematic. So it's kind of just an interesting bit of sociology. So the one I want to raise at the end, I think I know what you're going to say about this, is if I were to ask you, what effects do you envisage for your work? What would you say to that?
I don't.
Right, okay.
But that doesn't mean to say that I don't think about... I would say that I invest myself very deeply in whatever subject matter I'm looking at, and I hope by the degree of investment in what I'm doing and the way I try to realise it, that it will then be understandable to people. So it isn't that I don't think about the audience, I am testing on myself, does this make sense if I'm outside it? But I don't say, this must have this effect. I hope to set up situations where people bring their own imaginations and sensations to what I do, and I'm constantly surprised when they do respond.
Okay, fantastic. If it's very, very quick, it's very quick.
Very brief. But I want to add a bit to what Jen said, because I think very importantly in her work she's giving people an offer and leaving it to them to complete it.
Yes,
no, I mean, I think that's so interesting. You know, so we've had other people who, for example, working in a specifically political vein, well, obviously they've thought you know, it's very important that what the kind of strategies of effect are. And then, you know, like I hear what he says, it's an offer that then requires an imaginative rejoinder from each and every person. And that, you know, that seems very interesting.
One of the best responses I got to the Crypt Gallery, and as I said, I did want to have an effect there. I wanted people to register that, but I didn't want to tell them. I wanted them to experience that in their own way and for themselves. But one of the best responses I got was from somebody who said, what I liked about it was you didn't tell me what to think, you just required a response.
Yeah.
And he was the person who also said, of course you should carry on as an artist, it's a no-brainer.
You created a situation in which that could happen.
Yeah. That, yes, up. And that was the effect, I suppose, that I wanted. Yes. Yeah.
And on that note, I would just like to thank Fernandez Wells for letting us do this here. I would like to thank Evelyn and TCC for supporting it. Most of all, I would like to thank Jane, obviously, for agreeing to do this, and all of you for coming. So, thank you very much.